Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms and now on some radio stations. Washington has been abuzz by a scandal over... I guess what one would call OPSEC, failure of operational security, with Atlantic Monthly editor Jeffrey Goldberg mistakenly being included in a group chat that was discussing the war. And I wanted to take up that issue, but maybe offer a broader perspective, because I think a lot of the Washington dispute right now is about, you know, was a security breakdown. How did this happen? Who's responsible? But the meeting was all about launching a war on Yemen and bombing Yemen. And I think maybe the larger scandal is the fact, why is the United States bombing Yemen? Is there any rationale? Because there's certainly some people, even in the meeting, kind of had questions about that. So to talk about all that, I'm very happy to have on a frequent guest of the program, Matt Duss, a foreign policy expert, vice president at the Center for International Policy. Matt, first of all, welcome.
Thanks, Jeet. Great to be here again.
And let's just like launch into this. Like, what's your kind of big picture take on this scandal?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you said, I mean, yes, of course, this is a failure of security. It's an embarrassing screw up. By the administration, particularly National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who accidentally, you know, invited journalist Jeffrey Goldberg into the chat. But also, it's a statement about, you know, Washington and what Washington chooses to be, you know, outraged about, right? And it's choosing to be outraged about this, you know, this OPSEC, this failure of OPSEC, failure of operational security, when I think the real scandal here is the United States is continuing to wage undeclared, unauthorized war against the region's poorest country. And not just that, it's doing so essentially in defense of our extremely powerful and prosperous partner state, Israel, as it continues to wage a series of mass atrocities against Gaza, which has been plausibly labeled a genocide by many experts on genocide. You know, I have no love for the Houthis. They're a bad bunch of guys. I don't support attacking international shipping, which is what they have been doing. But they have also been clear that they are carrying out those attacks in protest of the Gaza war and will stop when the Gaza war stops. And of course, they did stop during the ceasefire and started them again when Israel broke that ceasefire. And it's just, it was maddening and crazy when the Biden administration did this. Rather than reining in Israel's war, it chose to bomb the Houthis, and Trump is doing the same thing now, just more of it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely right. I mean, there's a couple of things to bring out from what you've just said. One is, just the question of like, you know, like, is this actually in America's national interest? And I actually thought, I mean, it was very interesting in the, you know, the actual contents of the group chat. One person who did raise it is Vice President J.D. Vance, who basically said, you know, well, we only get 3% of our shipping from the Suez Canal. Europe gets 40%. You know, we're supposed to be doing America first. What's going on? Now that's an, you know, so-called isolationist position that I don't necessarily like agree with. But I think it does raise the interesting question. Like, what is the American actual stake in this?
Right. I mean, I don't, and again, I mean, you know me, this is one of my, I don't tend to like the term isolationist. But I think what is interesting about that is it was basically, it wasn't challenging the idea that the Houthis need to be bombed. It was that shouldn't the Europeans be bombing the Houthis instead of the United States, given that they get so much more of their oil traverses through the Red Sea compared to the United States. It was part of, you know, Vance's broader argument that, and Trump's, frankly, that Europeans are a bunch of free riders who've been, you know, prospering underneath a U.S. financed security umbrella, just extending that logic now to the Middle East. But yes, I mean, Vance, and it's, I need to go back and look, but at some point early in the chat, you had not the principals, but actually their senior advisors weighing in on their behalf. So that was Andy Baker, who is J.D. Vance's chief foreign policy advisor. Again, this is, I need to go back and look at what point like the principals actually took over and were speaking for themselves. But be that as it may, J.D. Vance or Baker were the only ones to really pump the brakes at all on the idea that we should be doing this. Now, I don't agree with the logic of why we shouldn't be doing it. As I said, we shouldn't be doing it because, A, most importantly, it doesn't work. I mean, people have been bombing the shit out of the Houthis literally for 10 years. I mean, the Saudi UAE offensive against the Houthis began in March 2015. You know, the Obama administration initially supported it. Then they kind of dialed down support. You know, Trump came in and dialed up support. Biden came in and, you know, tried, I did think, made a good faith effort to support peace talks, named a special envoy, Tim Wenderking, to help facilitate and work with the UN to bring the war to a close. But of course, after the Gaza war started and the Houthis launched these attacks, he launched attacks in response. And again, Trump has picked that up. And here we are with the Houthis still maintaining these capabilities. They will continue to do this. We should have no doubt. But, you know, you look at some of the exchanges on this text chain and you see these usual kind of nonsense terms that Washington loves to use to talk about these kinds of things, like, you know, restoring deterrence. We need to restore deterrence. We need to show strength. We need to blow a bunch of shit up in order to show we mean business. And then we'll restore deterrence. It's like, we've been restoring deterrence with the Houthis for 10 years. At what point do you actually ask the question, maybe we're not actually doing that?
Yeah. No, I mean, the sort of ineffectuality of all this is, cuts to the heart of the question of why we should be doing it, especially since, you've indicated this, but I really want to underscore this. Like, you know, if the concern is the shipping route through the Suez, and if, you know, you feel that the U.S., that is a U.S. responsibility, you know, the simplest way to keep that shipping route open is to just, like, you know, tell the Israelis you cannot continue the siege of Gaza. You have to follow through on the ceasefire. And, you know, like, that would work.
Right, and ending the siege of Gaza and the obliteration of Gaza would be a great thing to do in and of itself. But it will have this bonus effect of ending attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea.
Yeah. No. And maybe pulling back here, I mean, like, to me, interesting. Like, I think that in the Trump administration, more than most administrations, you see a lot of, like, sort of back and forth in terms of policies, that there are different factions at work. And it seems like it really depends on who has Trump's ear at a particular moment as to what's going forward. With the larger policy, they did, there was a ceasefire negotiated towards the very end of Biden's term, and it was being followed through. And there were other indications that it looked like the Trump administration was going to, like, try, you know, to be serious about a new tack, including having an envoy there who very specifically said, you know, the U.S. is not acting as an agent of Israel, and was, like, negotiating with Hamas separately from Israel, which was a very big deal.
And a good thing to do.
Yeah, and a good thing to do, yes. And now, I mean, that lasted, like, not very long. And now they seem to be back to what I consider basically Biden's policy, which is, like, no daylight between Israel and the U.S. So do you have any sense of, like, what are the factions, or, like, why the sudden shift?
I mean, there are, you know, you could see some of this in that text chain, but it's also fairly well known. There's basically three factions in terms of foreign policy in the Trump administration. You've got the prioritizers, who are, you know, who believe that the United States is bogged down in the Middle East and Europe. We're overinvested in these places, and the real action is China and Asia. You know, I think Bridge Colby is one of the most notable kind of, you know, intellectuals behind this idea. You've got the restrainers or the retrenchers, whatever term you want to use, who just believes the United States is overinvested everywhere. You know, people often term them isolationists. And again, I don't agree with that term. I think, you know, restrainers, you know, do believe in a pretty robust international role for the United States. They just, compared to like the huge role we have right now, it is less than that. And then you've got the old school, essentially the Reaganites or the neoconservatives or whatever term you want to use, who just believes the United States can and must be everywhere all the time. There are never any trade-offs, and trade-offs is the language of decline, and we don't believe in decline. And Mike Waltz basically comes from this school, which also explains...
Now, who would be the retrenchers? Because, I mean, you have sort of like Bridge Colby as a prioritizer. Who would you put in the retrencher category as?
You know, I think Vance probably falls into this. You know, he has not spoken much about China, as far as I know. I mean, frankly, neither has Trump, interestingly, in the first few months of this administration. But as I was saying, like, Mike Waltz is very much for this old school Reaganite, faction, which is dwindling. Thank goodness it is dwindling. Because it has become clear that it doesn't really represent any meaningful faction of voters, which is, you know, also something that Kamala Harris found out when she tried to campaign with Liz Cheney. But that also explains why Mike Waltz had Jeffrey Goldberg's number on his phone, because being from this, you know, school, I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg is himself kind of on the liberal side of the Reaganite sort of neoconservative ideology. You know, and I've heard this from multiple sources close to the administration. It was like, oh, of course, Waltz had Jeffrey's number because he leaks to Jeffrey Goldberg.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And even in, like, you know, Goldberg's initial piece, like announcing this leak, like he actually, like, very early on goes to, you know, some length to say, like, how evil the Houthis are.
Pause there for a minute. Yes, I mean, this is, again, he's like, we need to start with him history. Right after October 7, you know, that's where the history begins. Like, oh my God. This is one of the weird things about this story, is that Jeffrey Goldberg, of all people, is a hero in this story. He is... You know, among prominent foreign policy journalists, he has done more to keep our conversation stupid over the past 20 years. He has played such a role in our dumb foreign policy debates.
That exactly explains why he was on the group chain, which otherwise would not make sense. Because, I mean, otherwise, The Atlantic is like a very anti-Trump magazine, but anti-Trump, you know, in alliance with some of the more old school Reaganites, right. So you have these three camps, and it does seem like, at least with both the bombing in Yemen, but I think more broadly, sort of Middle Eastern policy, like the sort of both the restrainer and prioritizing arguments are like have fallen by the wayside. You've seen a reversion to, you know, like we can continue being involved in the Middle East.
There's also a consistency, and again, I don't want to, you know, pretend that any of these ideological factions are pure. No ideology really is. But we saw this in the first Trump term too. I mean, he doesn't want to get bogged down in the Middle East, but he does believe, you know, sometimes you just got to hit people really hard and show that you're still the biggest guy on the block, and then you go back to your business. Now, that's an illusion. We constantly find this out, but it is a very politically attractive illusion.
And in itself, I've always seen that as a kind of like mark of political decline. There's a neocon, infamous one, Michael Ledeen, who said every few years the U.S. has to pick, you know, some tiny country and push it against the wall just to prove it can. Well, you know, like that sort of belligerence and bullying, like, you know, like, to, you know, like, that's not what you do when you're strong. Like, you have, you kind of have to do it when you have to, like, constantly prove that you you still have muscle. And it's a power to destroy or to harm. It's not a power to actually, like, persuade or, you know, engage the world.
Yeah, and also to note, just as a, you know, a strategy for security, sometimes people whose countries you do that to respond in ways that we don't like knocking down the Twin Tower.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it has all, like, obviously all sorts of, like, very dire consequences. In some ways, I mean, like, to me, I mean, it's good. Like, we're zeroing in on this aspect of Trump's psychology, this need to, like, you know, have shows of force, because to me, like, this undermines anything that's kind of, like, promising in terms of, like, restraint or having a sense of priority. Like, it ultimately, you know, goes back down to kind of reptile brain, you know, like, I'm the strongest guy, I have to prove it. And if that's the case, you're not going to be able to really move on from all, you know, like, you know, all the problems with American foreign policy that we agree on.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But I would also just say, like, I don't think we should have any illusions that Trump is going to remake U.S. foreign policy in a good, constructive, durable way. The value he brings, and I do think this is an important value, is showing that the existing foreign policy consensus is shallow, broken, out of date, and that there is actually far more room and political space to define a new foreign policy than many, you know, ideologues of the old school in the blob or whatever term you want to use would have us believe. They've always insisted, oh, everyone believes we must continue to do all these things to protect ourselves and protect the world, and all these kind of assumptions are unquestionable. Trump has very helpfully shown that that's all a bunch of bullshit. Now, and, you know, there are people inside his administration, I think some of whom I think have interesting ideas, some of whom have ideas that are just destructive in a different way. But I think the value he does bring, and this is going to require more of us on the Democratic and progressive side to offer real and durable alternatives for share, you know, for security for our country, but also the concept that our security has to be shared as much as possible globally.
Yeah, no, no, I think that's right. And in terms of, I mean, it might be worth, like, because I think that there's now, like, a real fight going on within these different factions. And I don't know if you saw, like, this morning, Vice President Vance was basically going after Jewish Insider, which had been publishing a lot of critiques of various nominees that were coming out of the more restrainer end and more prioritizing end, like you know, Bridge Colby being a good example. They did a kind of big takedown of it. I mean, like, it's, to me, it's an interesting question, like, where do we kind of stand on this? Because I, like, you know, like, on the one hand, Bridge Colby is not someone whose foreign policy worldview, like, I would share at all. Like, and maybe you can flesh this out a little bit more. But my sense is that he's a real China hawk, and that he wants to, you know, draw back from the Middle East and from Europe, so the U.S. could concentrate on, you know, great power competition with China. And it's that China aspect that worries me, because, I mean, like, you know, if we do get a world war, it's like, that's the most likely scenario. But having said that, like, you know, like, I also think, like, you know, having someone like Colby, you know, in a Republican White House, he could counter some of the more, you know, destructive tendencies, and maybe push for more negotiations in Europe and in the Middle East. But I mean, like, it's a real, like, challenge. Like, how do we think about someone like Bridge Colby?
Yeah, and I'll say, I mean, I know Bridge a little bit. I mean, I would agree that I think some of his ideas, I mean, he's far more hawkish on China than I am. I think some of his ideas about U.S.-China policy are potentially dangerous and lead pretty clearly and inevitably to conflict. But I'll say this. I feel like Bridge Colby is committed to having a good faith debate about these issues. You know, he has a conception of the U.S. national interest. I don't share it. I don't define it as he does. But, you know, I think he does have a pretty coherent theory of how the United States needs to protect its security and prosperity. But, you know, there are areas of overlap. I mean, when he says the United States needs to draw down in the Middle East and we should stop, you know, over-investing in some of these other areas. I mean, there is a Venn diagram where I should, and except, you know, successful politics and policy work, where, you know, I think really requires identifying those areas of shared, priorities and goals. I mean, I'd use for an example, look at, Bernie working with Mike Lee, right, on Yemen. Like Mike Lee, Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy worked together on Yemen during the first Trump administration. You know, Bernie and Mike Lee don't agree on a whole lot. They probably disagree on 90% of everything. But they did agree that, the United States shouldn't be backing a war in Yemen. So the question is, okay, let's strategically, how do we work with people with whom we have huge disagreements on issues of, on ideas that we do share? And I do share some foreign policy ideas with Bridge, not a lot. And I'll, but compared to, the kind of old neoconservative Reaganite faction, who just believe in just sustaining American global military hegemony everywhere all the time, I find that far more dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
Than what I'm hearing from Bridge. And to the extent that Bridge, and I don't want to keep focusing on Bridge personally, a lot of people bringing up, but I do, just as I said earlier, I do think it is refreshing. There have been a number of people who've been brought in. And I think the fact that Jewish Insider, which again is basically just an instrument of the neoconservative pro-Israel right, I mean, that's what it does. It just attacks, both progressives and conservatives who don't share, the kind of prioritizing of the U.S.-Israel relationship or the prioritizing of Israeli security concerns that, AIPAC and that whole faction demands. The fact that we are getting people who have different ideas in the Trump administration, I think is important and good. I think our existing foreign policy establishment does need to be destroyed. I think we need to be thinking about how we do more of that on the Democratic side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think that's the point about coalition building, I think, is maybe something to pick up on. And I think it's maybe worth explaining in some a little bit more detail, which is that the way the American political system works is actually very hard for one political party to pass anything through one political party. You kind of always need some sort of consensus, especially in the Senate. And it is the case, and one sees this with the party of American hegemony, American imperialism. It's that's always been a bipartisan project that has brought in Republicans and Democrats, and so any less interventionist policy will also have to have that component.
But I think we do have the benefit of that more, a majority of Americans agree with this now, right? And again, this goes to, what Trump helped reveal is that, this presumption that the American people support this global military hegemony of the unipolar moment, it's a mirage.
Yeah, yeah, no. I guess the question is, on the Democratic side, are we going to actually see a shift? Because it seems to me that the Biden administration, although they did do certain really good things, and I think in part because of their awareness that things had changed. You'd mentioned the negotiations in mm-hmm. Yemen, and I'll mention the withdrawal from Afghanistan, where they paid a real political price. Is there a possibility for a bigger shift on the Democratic Party side, especially since Trump is putting these ideas out in the open, so they might have to realize that there's political competition? And
I think there is a real possibility, and let's remember, the reason, we got Biden to commit to ending the forever wars, even though he seemed to think it was one forever war, Afghanistan. The reason Biden committed to, trying to bring an end to the Yemen war and diminishing U.S. support for the Saudi war, even though he didn't completely end it, which is what he had previously committed to, even getting those things from Biden were a result of effective pressure from the progressive left, from, you know, from work from Bernie, from others in the Congress. You know, I think what we need to do is look toward 2028. I mean, having a president, a set of candidates in the primary who can really put these issues on the board, who can, and who can, if even if they don't become the nominee, which I hope we will have a nominee who is really committed to envisioning a new role, a new global role for the United States, one that is not based on this nostalgia of this kind of old unipolar moment primacy, as Biden was. Even if that does not become the nominee, as I hope we should all work and make sure it is, you know, having a nominee who at least is forced to commit to taking some of these steps and bringing in people who will help execute some of these changes is going to be really, really important.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, I mean, it is interesting the sort of state of flux in American foreign policy. And one thought I wanted to put out there and get your maybe reaction to is I kind of worry that, like, precisely because of the sort of incompetence that we've seen with in this thing on the OPSEC side, and even though the incompetence here was coming from, like, I guess the one of the most neoconservative members of the Trump administration, still I do think that, like, these controversies maybe allow the old order to, like, regain a foothold, that, you know, they will say, like, to Trump and others, you're messing around. You have to put the professionals back in. You have to bring in the old guard. You have to bring back John Bolton or whatever, right? Like, not that I think that's going to happen, but I think we saw that in Trump's first term, where, you know, precisely because he has such a weak policy background and he didn't know, you know, who people were, basically, he was coming from outside of Washington. He was very susceptible to, like, you know, pointing people from the old guard, from the the blog, the blob, and I'm kind of worried that this current scandal will be used as an opportunity for old Washington to retrench. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a reasonable concern. I would say, this Trump term versus much different from the first one. I mean, Trump has people around him and a wider network of people committed to, you know, his kind of rough, you know, foreign policy program, such as it is. I think he and his team have learned considerably more about how Washington works to make him less susceptible, I think, to that kind of pressure. I mean, his control of the party, the fact that he controls both houses, I mean, is more vast than it was the first time. And I think the concern I do share is just Washington being as it is, you know, whenever you get into trouble, blowing some shit up is always an easy way to get people back on your side. I'm thinking back to, it was like April 2017, just a couple months into his first term, where he, you know, launched some strikes at Syria. And, you know, we saw... Who was it? Was it Fareed Zakaria saying Donald Trump became president?
Yeah, no, that was a wide restraint. You heard it all over CNN. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right. And so what that teaches Donald Trump is, like, well, when you get in trouble, here's a button you can push that, you know, makes Washington like you again. That is an indictment of Washington and the very dumb way it talks about foreign policy. But unfortunately, that's the current reality.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I worry about it on, like, a number of fronts. I actually think the way things are playing out in Europe, especially if, the sort of settlement that Trump is heading towards, you know, will be basically a huge concession on the part of Russia, and will be attacked on those terms, and perhaps rightly so. I mean, I think Trump is willing to give away more than he should, but then I think that also creates the exact incentive structure that you outlined, that, well, then, you know, if you're going to be attacked for being weak on Ukraine, then, like, yes, blow up more things in the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah. Find some other area where you can launch some cruise missiles, you know, so that the columnists will like you again, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah. And I mean, I think that if we're trying to conceptualize this as a sort of change in you know, a period of flux in foreign policy where there are like different factions and more voices being heard than before. I do actually think like one of the weakest links is the sort of mainstream media, which is, you know, precisely still entrenched in the sort of blob foreign policy. And in fact, I mean, in that way, you know, to go back to the point that you made about Jeffrey Goldberg, I mean, it's not an accident. It's absolutely not an accident that Jeffrey Goldberg is at the center of the story.
One of the reporters whose shitty work helped drive us into the Iraq catastrophe. But that, again, that's unfortunately, you know, just a great example of how Washington works. Like the people who would be asked to come on TV and comment on Trump's foreign policy screw-ups are former officials who've catastrophically been fucking up American foreign policy for the past 20 years, almost without exception.
So. That's right, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, certainly, like, you know, very interesting times. And I think maybe the takeaway I want to leave with listeners is that, like, you know, the focus that, you know, the media and I think Congress has on OPSEC, I think almost does a disservice to like what's actually, you know, a much bigger story that reveals a lot of huge fissures in American foreign policy. On that note, I think Matt has a busy day, so we'll end it there. But I will revisit this conversation, I'm sure, in the near future.
Thanks, G. Glad to be here again.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you've got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.